Indie Media is DIY news. It is about people reporting their own news directly without the need for reporters, bypassing the corporate media.
There are 100 Indie Media or IMC websites worldwide providing grassroots reports of struggles, campaigns and protests.
There are so many people here who are saying no to the government today, and this is democracy in action.
Everybody's here. Everybody in the country seems to be here. They're just coming from all over the place. The banners are showing all the tiny, tiny little pockets of the country. Everybody has come down here.
The project started 3 years ago, covering the massive Seattle protests, which shut down the World Trade Organization's summit.
Uncensored and unsponsored, IMC sites can be updated anywhere, anytime, by anyone.
The open-to-all nature of these sites means that you can publish your own reports about your own issues and at the same time connect to a global network of grassroots news. What you are about to hear are some highlights from these global websites and from our very own UK IMC Wire. For more information or to get the news direct from the streets, check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
Hello and welcome to the show. You're listening to Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4. It's Wednesday the 24th of March. Now, as you may have heard, last weekend was the first anniversary of the start of the attacks against Iraq and the immediate massive worldwide anti-war protests that accompanied it. While smaller than previous demonstrations, last weekend saw millions around the world demonstrating, both on March the 19th, the actual anniversary, as well as Saturday the 20th, the anniversary of worldwide protests. In Iraq, a demonstration took place in Baghdad, in tandem with the protests around the world. The protest was also a powerful show of unity between Sunni and Shia Muslims. The marches started in different places, and the two groups met just as the Shias came over a bridge, and emotions were high as they merged into one. Then together they walked to a public square where speakers denounced the occupation and called for unity between all Iraqis. Although, as said, turnouts across the world were not as great as the February 2003 massive rallies, protests did occur in around 300 cities across the world. In the UK, there were protests in many cities, including Glasgow and Bristol. In London, the National Stop the War Coalition demonstration saw tens of thousands of people filling the streets throughout the afternoon in a march from Hyde Park to Trafalgar Square. While the police said 25,000 people attended, the Stop the War Coalition put the figures at 100,000. Many commentators, as usual, put the figure at somewhere in between. It certainly took well over an hour and a half for the march to leave the park and just over 2 hours to snake its way to Trafalgar Square. Earlier in the day, two Greenpeace activists had climbed up Big Ben to unfurl a banner reading Time for Truth, sparking yet another debate about anti-terrorist security.
On the demonstration, there were two samba bands, several bicycle sound systems, the debut of some colourful radical cheerleaders, free food, yoga, meditation, a free microphone contraption, Green Party stalls, a kids area, an anti-authoritarian bloc, the New Respect Coalition Party, and a lot of banners in the crowd. 2,000 black balloons were released in memory of those killed in the Iraq conflict, as well as Madrid. Lots of Spanish people were out on the streets, and there were also very few police. Dark clouds, a little rain, oh, and Chris Eubank, in a huge anti-war truck rig, ringed by police shaking hands with people from the cab. One person was arrested by police near to Chris Eubank's truck on the flimsiest of pretexts for videoing police while standing on the other side of the white ribbon used to split the road in half and mark the march route. His footage was seized by the police. The demonstration also saw the first outing of Code Pink in the UK. Code Pink is a women's organisation that last year gathered 10,000 women to surround the White House and protest against the war. Speakers at Trafalgar Square included George Galloway, Jeremy Corbyn and Lindsay German, and Dr. Aziz Tamimi from the Muslim Association of Great Britain, as well as Louise Christian, a lawyer representing one of the Britons recently released from Guantanamo Bay. In Dublin, over 6,000 people marched despite the rain, and speaker after speaker called for massive protests for when G.W. Bush visits Ireland on June the 25th and 26th. Every month, 10,000 US troops travel through Shannon Airport in the west of Ireland. Shannon is also the likely entry point for Bush, who is seeking favour with the 40 million Irish Americans in what could prove a close election, if you could call it that. Around the world, there are events from small vigils to massive marches. In East Timor, for example, 50 people demonstrated, while in Rome, reports speak of between 1 to 2 million people. Spain saw several demonstrations of over 100,000, as well as huge protests in America and Japan. In Manila, over 1,000 people protesting were attacked by police using fire hoses. For more on the protests, check out the Global Indie Media portal, that sounds very space age, at www.indiemedia.org.
The day before the 20th, on Friday, Yorkshire CND held a mass non-violent blockade at the key US military base Menwith Hill, near Yorkshire. Over 200 people blocked three gates completely, causing tailbacks for hours and massively disrupting the shift changeover. Menwith Hill felt compelled to issue a statement, which is amazing since they never ever issue statements or speak to anyone. The action, Block the Base, started in freezing, driving rain at 5 a.m. in the morning, with protesters who had stayed in Leeds overnight blockading. Many protesters were met by police waiting for them when they arrived, yet they managed to block all four gates of the base, many locking themselves together. The shift change between 5:30 and 7 a.m. essentially turned into a traffic jam. The police had moved pretty fast to try and clear the first two gates, and reports were that they were pretty brutal with dangerous use of cutting equipment to remove people from lock-ons. Yorkshire CND said that despite advanced liaison with the police in fact ignored most of the agreements and behaved disgracefully, they say. There were definite cases of extreme excessive force and violence. CND are now saying they want as much information and as many pictures as possible from anyone who was there to collect evidence. The police also arrested a man for driving a van with a public address system in it and kept the keys of the van. So the campaigners lost their PA system and megaphones. By 7 a.m, most of the protesters at Gate 1 had been removed and were waiting, wet and cold, to be arrested. In all, 30 people were arrested, but the other gates were still blocked. The event, of course, was part of the International Weekend of Actions to mark the anniversary of the attacks on Iraq, but it was also aimed at highlighting Menwith Hill's key role in so many aspects of current US foreign policy. The base is the largest military spy base in the world, run by the US National Security Agency. It's also a key US warfighting base, winning an award for its role in the Gulf War, and a major Star Wars base. Indeed, it is one of the US's most strategically important military bases.
Just can't stop it, the way I drop it.
yesterday morning, around 70 police bailiffs and specialist climbers and tunnellers began evicting the tree camps at Blackwood in South Wales, where locals have been campaigning against a new road for over a decade. Around 10 people were arrested as they resisted in the trees, on walkways, in nets and in a tunnel, some after breaching cordons. Crowds of supportive locals looked on from behind the police cordon, as did local TV and media. At Camp Kerry, one brave activist still remained at the end of the day and was able to climb down without being arrested. Blackwood resident Barbara Davis said, "It's very sad. We've lived with these trees for all this time. It's a place where families go for walks on Sundays." Another resident, Sian Morgan, added, "It's total disrespect for our lives. You do not have to be an eco-warrior to appreciate that." The mother of Manic Street Preachers guitarist Nikki Wire has been part of the campaign to save the trees. Irene Jones said, "I can't put into words how upset I feel today. Hundreds and hundreds of years of history will soon be gone. The protesters have been wonderful. They've been so brave with all this going on around them, but I don't feel that I've done enough." Despite an appeal against the eviction order still pending in the courts, Gwent Under-Sheriff David Bowen said, "All I'm here to do is to enforce the court order. I believe that the appeal process has been fully exhausted and we are not aware of any new appeal." Most of the trees were destroyed yesterday, but some remain, both at Camp Kerry and at a third camp. Local campaigners say they will continue resisting today and beyond. For more information, check out Indie Media UK or Indie Media Bristol at bristol.indiemedia.org.
And in related news, as we reported some weeks ago, Tony Wrench of a community in Wales has been ordered to pull his turf-roofed roundhouse down. Sorry, that's not in Wales at all. I've got that mistaken. In Pembrokeshire National Park, he's been ordered to pull his turf-roofed roundhouse down by the Park Planning Authority. After paying £1,000 of fines, he is planning to take down his roundhouse in Easter. And we reported some weeks ago that there was going to be a camp there to take it down. Well, there's been some new developments. His eco house, which people say is a national treasure and a historic relic, indeed an inspiration to thousands of other people in the eco building industry. At the same time as this has been happening, the gobsmackingly blatant display of double standards by the Parks Planning Committee, which has given Alfred McAlpine permission to erect 350 holiday chalets in the park, and they're not even going to be built here, they're going to be imported from Estonia, has enraged many campaigners. And now the campaign group The Land Is Ours and others are organising a land occupation protest and a low impact dwelling convention over the Easter weekend in the park. That's the 8th to the 13th of April. They say the protest and the dwelling convention will include construction of another turf-roofed roundhouse in the national park and the first ideal low-impact home exhibition, as well as several protests and workshops and practical trainings in renewable living and eco-construction. And for more on this, see www.tlio.org.uk, and that stands for The Land Is Ours. In South Africa recently, police opened fire with stun grenades on members of the Gauteng Anti-Privatisation Forum, the APF, who were protesting against water privatisation and the installation of prepaid water meters. 52 APF members were arrested, including 6 children, on charges of violating something called the Gatherings Act. Supporters were asked by police to disperse within 3 minutes, one by one, and as they did, the police began to shoot at them. Several were wounded. The Gatherings Act is a piece of law dating back from the apartheid era, which gives police broad powers to ban or otherwise interfere with legitimate protest action. Last Thursday, mere days before the action was due to take place, the Johannesburg Metropolitan Police denied permission for the Coalition Against Water Privatisation on the grounds that the protest would be violent. Well, no previous APF protest had been violent. They also said that the protest would disrupt traffic and would constitute a threat to law and order. The coalition, with the assistance of one of its member organisations, the Freedom of Expression Institute, immediately drew up an appeal paper to get the ban overturned in court. However, in an unprecedented move, the sheriff of the court refused to carry out the expressed mandate of that office to serve such papers. When the coalition's lawyers finally managed to secure a court hearing late on Friday, the magistrate dismissed the appeal on a technicality. The day of the protests saw the opening of the new constitutional court building. Yet 10 years after the end of apartheid, many poor people in South Africa are still denied their constitutional rights to water and other basic services. And this is why the APF decided that the march had to go ahead, apartheid-era banning orders or not.
The struggle against water privatisation in South Africa Township came in the name of development to bring free and clean water by means of prepaid meters. The decision to install the meters had already been made. They never consulted the residents as to the type of water services the community would prefer. Johannesburg Water, a private company that is part of the French transnational corporation Suez Lyonnais, was given a contract to manage Johannesburg's water services. In 2001, they came to install meters in Orange Farm. Now they face a crisis around water delivery, notably the installation of prepaid meters. A minimal infrastructure for water services was already in place. People were receiving water to meet their basic needs, although in certain areas water was only provided in the form of communal standpipes. The constitutional right to water was thus being met. The residents of Orange Farm resisted the approach of Johannesburg Water and made local government aware that the community was not in agreement with prepaid meters. The community organised itself into the Orange Farm Water Crisis Committee and joined forces with similar organisations in Gauteng under the umbrella of the Anti-Privatisation Forum.
The Crisis Committee marched repeatedly on local government and presented memorandums spelling out their demands, including the free water promised by the ANC in the 1999 local government elections. Local government rejected these demands and divided the people, saying that installing water meters would create jobs for the unemployed in the area. Those employed, with the assistance of the police, harassed those against prepayment meters. One of the residents active in the campaign, the late Emily Lengolo, was assassinated in the middle of the night while sleeping at home. Until today, it is not known who was responsible, as the police are failing to investigate that crime. The killers are still at large, and others fighting for their rights worry that their lives are also at risk. The people of Orange Farm see the meters as denying them their freedom and constitutional rights. They developed the slogan, "Destroy the meters and enjoy free water," and this has now become a slogan for the international movement advancing people's right to water.
Since the meters have been installed, people are experiencing hardship. At night, people find that the meters have cut off their water. You cannot talk to a meter, so people are forced to devise other means to get water. They have to borrow from neighbours or walk further afield. Those with small vegetable gardens are unable to water their vegetables, which die as a result. Johannesburg Water claims that prepayment water systems allows people to receive the first 6,000 litres per household per month for free, but this is not happening. In fact, when you purchase the tokens for water, there is nothing on the slips of purchase to indicate how many litres have been paid for. Now Johannesburg Water is trying to install prepaid meters in Firi, Soweto. The company is again imposing the meters on an unwilling community and victimising those that are organising against the meters in the form of harassment, arrests and criminal charges. There are two main reasons behind the attempt to impose prepaid meters on communities. The first is the privatisation of the water service in Johannesburg. The second reason relates to the construction of Lesotho Highlands Water Project. This is a series of dams and tunnels to divert water from the Orange River to the Vaal River, Gutang and surrounding provinces.
This is an enormously expensive project designed by the World Bank during the years of apartheid. In essence, the project puts billions of rands into the pockets of transnational corporations from Europe and North America to build infrastructure that many say is not needed. It is for these reasons that the Orange Farm community and others are continuing to contest prepaid meters and privatisation, and to link up with communities in Gauteng, the rest of South Africa, Lesotho, Canada and other countries to stand together against this exploitation. The struggle is thus indeed about challenging private interests and promoting public goods. It is a struggle to root out neoliberalism and replace it with a system that addresses people's needs. And for more on this story, you can check out www.s-j-c.net. That's s-j-c.net.
Chrysanthemum.
For you, I am a chrysanthemum, supernova, urgent star.
Asteracum.
For you, I'd be a dandelion, a thousand flowerets in the sky, or just a drop in the ocean.
Salah Hassan, a cameraman for the Al Jazeera News Network, was arrested by US troops at the site of a roadside bomb attack on a US military convoy in Iraq last November. US troops accused him of knowing in advance of the attack, even though his footage showed that he arrived at least half an hour after the attack. This heralded the beginning of 6 weeks of imprisonment, abuse, and torture. Salah was initially taken to the US military base at Baghdad Airport and held in a bathroom for 2 days. Next, he was flown bound and hooded to Tikrit, and finally Salah was moved to Abu Ghraib, a massive Saddam-built prison currently holding 13,000 prisoners, where he spent his first night standing naked for 11 hours in the cold winter air. The following day, Salah was given his prison-issue clothes, a puke-stained set of red overalls. He was then locked alone in a tiny cell. Meanwhile, Salah's employers at Al Jazeera hired a top lawyer to defend him. At the trial, Salah ended up being released for lack of evidence and dumped on a roadside outside of Baghdad. He is now back working for the news network.
On a slightly more light-hearted note, you may have heard this one, if not, check this out. TV news reports in America that showed Bush getting a standing ovation from potential voters have been exposed as fake. The US government also admitted that it paid actors to pose as journalists in video news releases sent to TV stations, as well as preparing scripts to be used by TV news anchors. Outrageous.
Some cheeky chaffy has managed to carve Tony Blair is a C, four-letter word, into the Commons table used by the Prime Minister. Now, you might have thought that the Conservatives being the opposition would have agreed with these sentiments, but obviously not, as Conservative MP Derek Conway criticised the bright clown and proudly stated furniture polishers were brought in straight away and the message was removed shortly before the Prime Minister's question session started. And across the Atlantic, a maintenance worker has been suspended after he displayed a sign with the word traitor on a snowplow while helping provide security for President Bush's motorcade in Ohio.
There now follows a party political broadcast on behalf of nobody.
Election time is here again, and we're being browbeaten to take part by the mainstream fringe parties alike. But most of us feel, quite rightly, that all the parties are the same and they're in it for their own power. They are convinced that all candidates are irrelevant to the real problems in our personal situations. But I'm here today to tell you there is a candidate who's different. Nobody. Of all the candidates you've been offered in the elections today, nobody will make sure that everyone has all they need. Nobody will ensure decent homes and living standards for all. Nobody will care for the environment. Nobody will put the power back in the hands of ordinary people. Nobody will take care of us. Isn't this all common sense? Your feelings, your needs, your potential to make your life better are constantly undermined by all the political parties, who obviously con and manipulate in order to get influence for themselves. But nobody believes in you. Nobody can do for you what you could and should do for yourself. So trust nobody to represent you. Vote for nobody. You know it makes sense. If nobody gets in, it'll be so much better for us all. Together, with nobody leading us, we can change our world.
That was a party political broadcast on behalf of nobody.
One of the biggest strikes in world history took place recently in India, but much of the media seemed to ignore it. The story briefly, India's Supreme Court had ruled that it was illegal for government workers to strike. So in order to protest the ruling and pressure the government, the workers went on strike. Tens of millions of workers at the end of February were on strike, shutting down government offices, schools, banks and hitting public transport. The response has been unprecedented. I don't remember when such a large strike took place in the past, said Trade Union Council Secretary Dev Roy. Our estimate is that between 40 to 50 million workers went on strike.
Europe urged to reject genetically modified rice. European governments are being urged to reject a genetically modified GM rice in order to protect the world's largest staple food from falling into the hands of multinational companies. Member states have only till Sunday the 28th of March to object to an application by German-based Bayer Crop Science to import into the EU a GM rice that has been modified to resist the company's own herbicide, glufosinate ammonium. It is the first time that a company asks for the authorization of GM rice in Europe. Both Friends of the Earth Europe and the German Coalition Against Bayer Dangers, CBG, claim that an EU approval of the rice will send a dangerous signal to developing countries and could lead to the eventual corporate takeover of one of the world's most important foods. Currently, 2.5 billion people depend on rice as a staple food. Gert Ritzema of Friends of the Earth said, "Allowing the import of GM rice into Europe will give the green light to multinationals to promote this unsustainable form of farming in developing countries. Allowing the world's most important staple food to fall into the hands of a company like Bayer is dangerous and an unprecedented move." For more, see www.cbgnetwork.org. Now, in related news, Syngenta Monsanto has withdrawn the last GM sugar beet from the UK national seed listing process. Now only one variety of GM fodder maize, one variety of GM winter oilseed rape, and one variety of spring oilseed rape, all owned by Bayer Crop Science, are left in the application process for the national seed list, a prerequisite for commercial growing. This compares with all 11 varieties a year ago and 58 varieties since 1994. Meanwhile, a Liberal councillor in Yorkshire is trying a novel way to ruin government plans to grow genetically modified maize by supplying people with organic maize seed for people to grow at home and in their gardens. In theory, they would then have to be consulted about any GM maize being planned for the area to avoid cross-contamination. See www.gmfreeridal.org.uk.
Over the next few days, Germany will take a decision that campaigners say will be critical in ensuring that the European Union takes decisive, not direct action on cutting greenhouse gas emissions, although maybe direct action could be more appropriate. The EU has so far been the world leader on taking action on climate change, although that's not particularly difficult. Now Germany's Minister for Economics is threatening to undermine the European Emissions Trading Directive. Although this has been criticised by many campaigners, it's almost one of the best instruments that we have for curbing climate emissions. Friends of the Earth are saying that we need your help in emailing German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder to adopt a strong policy and reject the attempt by the economics minister to undermine it. As the US and Australian governments have turned their backs on Kyoto and Russia is stalling on making its commitment, it is vital that the European Union takes decisive action. And for more on that and climate change, you can check out www.foe.co.uk. That's the Friends of the Earth website.
Yeah.
Later today, between 4:30 and 5:30 p.m. at Committee Room 8, the House of Commons, there will be a meeting chaired by John McDonnell MP with the Global Women's Strike. The US removed Haiti's elected president, John Bertrand Aristide, at gunpoint. Many people are concerned about attempts against another democratically elected president, Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. Venezuela is the fifth largest oil exporter in the world, yet 65% to 80% of its population lives in poverty. President Chavez was elected to reclaim the oil revenue to tackle poverty and corruption. Alarmed by the recent removal of Haiti's democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, by US troops and ongoing attempts to remove Venezuela's president, Hugo Chavez, early day motion 854 Venezuela has been tabled by John McDonnell MP, condemning such attempts and highlighting the achievements of the democratic Venezuelan government. Global Women's Strike, GWS, say it is urgent that MPs and MEPs speak out to prevent another Iraq or Haiti. Selma James and Nina Lopez from the Global Women's Strike have been invited to Venezuela three times by the Women's Institute. The Global Women's Strike recently organised a US speaking tour for Nora Castaneda, president of the Women's Development Bank. Miss James and Miss Lopez are available for interview. So for more information, contact Nina Lopez, Global Women's Strike, 0207 482 2496. Early day motion 854 Venezuela, John McDonnell, that this House condemns the interference of the United States of America in the eternal democratic affairs of the Republic of Venezuela, and in particular its covert attempts to secure the removal of President Chavez, whose government has used the country's considerable oil reserves to launch a program to tackle poverty, including specific measures targeted at women, such as the constitutional recognition of unwaged housework as economically productive, entitling housewives to social security benefits, the prioritization of single mothers and indigenous people for land distribution, the guaranteeing of food for pregnant women and nursing mothers, and the significant increase in access to education and decent housing for the poor. In defence of the sovereignty of Venezuela, which is building, they say, a caring economy under the shadow of US intervention. The US removed Haiti's elected president, John Bertrand Aristide. Many people are concerned about attempts against another democratically elected president, Hugo Chavez, being removed. And it says again, Venezuela is the fifth largest oil exporter in the world. So if people would like to go along to the House of Commons today between 4:30 and 5:30 p.m, they can hear the meeting between John McDonnell and Global Women's Strike.
Okay, ready. Let's do it.
Children don't forget this torture. just because you call her mother doesn't mean that she's your better.
An email received from United Families and Friends Campaign, info@uffc.org. They say Metropolitan Police Authority backs police against grieving family. The email says, "Dear friends, on Monday the 15th of March, a subcommittee of the Metropolitan Police Authority took the astonishing and disgraceful decision to give funds to an appeal by 8 officers against an inquest verdict that the death of Roger Sylvester in custody was an unlawful killing. That decision was taken beyond the public gaze, but on the 25th of March, the full meeting of the Metropolitan Police Association will be open to the public. Members of Roger's family will be attending to hear the Metropolitan Police Association members try and justify giving public money to help the police officers' trade union, the Police Federation, overturn the verdict of a jury of Londoners who carefully considered 4 weeks of evidence before deciding how Roger was killed." The email goes on to say and ask the question, "How can London's supposedly independent police authority claim to be even-handed and to increase community confidence and trust in London's police service when it takes sides against a grieving family who are likely to have no access to public funds?" The United Families and Friends Campaign, I'll give you their address again, www.uffc.org, and Inquest, and their website is www.inquest.org.uk, is demanding that this disgraceful decision is overturned at the meeting on the 25th of March. "We urge everyone who can be there at 10 a.m. to come along and support the Sylvester family. The meeting is Thursday, the 25th of March, 10 a.m, Metropolitan Police Authority Meeting Room 1, Ground Floor, 10 Dean Farrer Street, London, SW1, nearest tube, St James Park." And again, they say you can contact the United Families and Friends Campaign at info@uffc.org.
With Greenpeace activists having been in the news scaling Big Ben last week, something you may not have heard about was that just over a week ago, the trial of 14 Greenpeace activists finished with fines and sentences handed out by Southampton Magistrates Court. The 14 defendants were charged with aggravated trespass and criminal damage in relation to an action at Marchwood Military Base last year on the 4th of February 2003. Actions at the base prior to that had seen the boarding of military supply vessels and the Greenpeace flagship Rainbow Warrior blockading the port itself. Lawyers acting for Greenpeace claimed the defendants had the right to demonstrate under the infamous Human Rights Act. They also claimed that the charge of aggravated trespass, which differs from normal trespass in that the defendants are claimed to have prevented others, i.e. military personnel, from going about their lawful business, does not apply since they were preventing the military from engaging in what they say is an illegal war. Therefore, the defendants believe that they were obliged to take the action to prevent an illegal war from taking place. It is this defence that created the controversy around the case. The defence team had asked for the disclosure of the Attorney General's advice that he delivered to the Cabinet in the run-up to the war, in order to prove under British law that the war was illegal. But as you probably know, Blair has once again been successful in preventing this from being disclosed. Indeed, this was one piece of evidence that was crucial in the decision to dismiss the case against the GCHQ whistleblower, Catherine Gunn. The decision was handed down with all of the activists being found guilty of all charges and sentenced to 2 years conditional discharge and some with £50 fines. Those found guilty of criminal damage were ordered to pay the costs of repairing the fences and damage to the paintwork of the tanks. Interestingly, however, the judge concluded that the defendant's defence of acting to prevent the occurrence of, in their view, an illegal war, did not stand up, since the damage to the tanks was not sufficient to prevent them from being used in the upcoming war. So Greenpeace activists are wondering if they'd caused more serious damage, then would they actually have been found not guilty? An interesting one to watch. For more on that, check out www.greenpeace.org.uk.
Stefan Funk, an American conscientious objector to the Iraq War, was freed this week from a US Army jail after being locked up for 6 months. In the face of this unjust war, based on deception by our leaders, he said, "I could not remain silent. I spoke out so that others in the military would realise that they also have a choice and a duty to resist immoral and illegitimate orders." Last September, Stefan showed up to work for the Army 47 days late, clutching his conscientious objector papers in hand. He was accused of being away without leave, although the initial harsher accusation was desertion, which supporters claimed was an overreaction intended to scare other soldiers into keeping their concerns under wraps and their guns on display. Why so paranoid? Well, this week has seen a trickle of other potential objectors. Two US Army medics have applied, saying the idea of killing is to them revolting, as well as one sergeant who has vowed not to fight in this oil-driven war. Three more isn't exactly a trend, but according to the Center for Conscience on War, this small number of applicants is just the tip of the objector iceberg. They estimate that the number of military personnel seeking objector status at the moment is several hundred at the bare minimum. After completing a 22-question form and attending interviews, soldiers have to wait 6 months for applications to be processed, by which time they're probably eating out of mess tins anyway. According to the centre and their stats from previous wars, objectors waiting for their case to go through are often beaten, harassed, or threatened with court-martial. During the first Gulf War, the US Army received 111 applications from conscientious objectors before freezing the process and instead sending people to prison. For more information on this, see www.nisbco.org. I'll say that again and I'll spell it www.n for naughty, i for igloo, s for sam, b for bob, c for cauliflower, and o for organic.org.
And we're almost running out of time now. Remember, if you want to get in touch with the show, you can email the show at irl.newswire. That's irlnewswire@ziplip.com, irlnewswire@ziplip.com. Don't forget to check out the show next week. We'll be back. Of course, the website, indiemedia.org.uk, and many of the other indie media websites around the world.
Bye-bye.
Who'll pay reparations on my soul? Many suggestions and documents written. Oh yeah.
be a man.
Be a man.
You can't depend on no one else.